Hello there and welcome to the Last Horror Podcast. My name's Christopher Brown. Now, I don't know if you've got Netflix, but there's a documentary that's on there at the moment. I think it's PBS, it feels like PBS, a special called American Experience, War of the Worlds, 2013. Now, the doco is obviously about, you know, Orson Welles' rather amazing radio drama and like the aftermath and a lot of the stories around it. And well, here's the trailer.
We interrupt our program to bring you a special bulletin.
It's the most famous invasion that never happened.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed.
A broadcast that struck fear into an already anxious nation.
Alien army invader.
The War of the Worlds spoke directly to those fears and anxieties.
We all felt it was the end of the world.
War of the Worlds on American Experience.
Anyway, what it does is kind of suggest that the mass hysteria was real. And I was really curious about that. Because when I was a kid, that was the story, that was the assumed narrative that, you know, places in Texas, people were shooting the sky and people were diving into the cars and driving away. And this radio broadcast was hugely popular and it caused mayhem for whatever reasons. And then when I listened to it, I was a bit surprised because, yeah, it does have like a fake live broadcast moment in it. But generally, it doesn't feel like a real program. And certainly by the end of it, it kind of pulls it all back into being, you know, obviously not. And then as time's gone on, you kind of realise that there's an element of urban myth about War of the Worlds. That it's not really as the terrifying programme that people were really running out onto the streets. But the PBS special, as was, does make some interesting points. So what I thought I'd do today is not use a documentary as a basis for this and do my own research and kind of take a look at why, firstly, why it's possible that there was a scare and then why it's probably there wasn't, and also why there's also this kind of fascination. And even in the UK, we have our own similar kind of examples of such scares, I suppose.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells. Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the Mercury Theater and star of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, and yet as mortal as his own.
So Orson Welles was like a hotshot theater director who'd been given an opportunity to do radio plays as well. And this radio play was designed for Halloween on October the 30th, actually, like for some Mischief Night in 1938. It was aired over the Columbia Broadcasting Network. This was Welles post-Broadway, where he did Hamlet in Harlem, but pre-Citizen Kane. So Howard E. Koch, the screenwriter, was given the job of changing the book, which was obviously set in Victorian England, and you know, using first-hand reports, and kind of make it, you know, contemporary for the time. When he presented it, and Wells finally got a look at the script, which was due to tight schedules, relatively late, I think 3 days before the performance, Wells didn't like it, and so there were urgent rewrites made, a lot of which to kind of insert contemporaneous styles for broadcast to emulate how radio sounded then. This is particularly true of the first 12 to 15 minutes of the show. So what happens is we have a break from the radio, like a musical number. This is after it's already been announced it's a drama, a musical number, and then they go to part somewhere, a real place, kind of in New Jersey, and you hear a radio report, which I'll play a clip of now, of strange things happening.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see. More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them. No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who. Oh, yes, I believe it's Professor Pearson. Yes, it is. Now they've parted, and the professor moves around one side, studying the object while the captain and two policemen advance with something in their hands.
Over there.
I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from the mirror, and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods, the barns, the gas tanks, and the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Wells holds that silence for a really long time. And the reason why he holds it so long is because of the dramatic effect of it. And then slowly, but over, you know, slowly, quickly, over a period of very fast period of time, what he does is kind of tell this ridiculous narrative in truth of, you know, the army getting there, everyone getting massacred, you know, and basically the world's taken over in this narrative framework, which is meant to be real time, in about 40 minutes. So obviously it's a tad ridiculous, but it works well in the confines of its own structure, and it's not that surprising really, considering the fact that, you know, he only had an hour to do it in. And, you know, I think the thing that interested Wells was this sense of realism and kind of matching it in. So an actor called Frank Riddick actually went and listened to Herbert Morrison's radio report of the Hindenburg disaster. And when you put the two together, as you've just heard that bit, and I'll play a bit from the Hindenburg now, there are great similarities. And this radio is incredible, because you're basically hearing a man just in describing his utter horror, and it's insane. So we'll give that a go now.
It's starting to rain again. The rain had cracked up a little bit. The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames.
Get this started. It's crashing terrible. Oh, my. Get out of the way, please. It's burning and bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast, and all the folks between it. This is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. Oh, it's 400 or 500 feet into the sky. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now, and the flame is rising to the ground, not quite to the mooring mast. All the humanity and all the furniture screaming around it. I told you, I can't even talk to people. There's friends around there. I can't talk, ladies and gentlemen. Honestly, it's just laying there a mass of smoking wreckage. And everybody can't hardly breathe and talk and screaming. Lady, I'm sorry. Honestly, I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside while I cannot see it. Charlie, that's terrible. Listen, folks, I'm going to have to stop for a minute because I've lost the voice. This is the worst thing I've ever witnessed.
Indeed, after that, like, 40 minutes of action where the, you know, everything happens, you kind of just turn into this, like, monologue kind of thing, and it kind of wraps up relatively sedately and quite easily and simply. But that's not the thing that makes the War of the Worlds interesting. The concept, and I think one of the biggies, is the fact that because of Wells's cavalier attitude of putting on fake news reports, well, that sounded considerably real, even within a dubious framework. People were duped. And that duping was caused by, a few factors, I suppose. One was the fact that, life had been quite hard, and bad stories and bad news stories had kind of filtered in. And the other was that this idea of, radio kind of, breaking news flashes were common at the time, and they invariably were harbingers of terrible news coming from abroad. Things that, as events escalated with a great deal of speed in Europe. So a concept of an invader would not be that uncommon. And indeed, that paranoia of invasion is something that kind of permeates American culture. Right into the 50s and 60s with a numerous sci-fi horror. Anything from Invaders from Mars, for example, would be an obvious example. And obviously Invasion of the Body Snatchers too. A paranoia that the world around us is changing beyond our control. So from that point of view, it's not that surprising if you had only half an ear on it and you heard violence and, the army getting called in New Jersey, it would freak you out. I think there's an assumption that people always have, full attention on what they're doing. And in this case, that's probably unlikely. It was a Sunday night, 8 o'clock. I don't know about what your Sunday nights are at 8 o'clock, but normally I've had a glass of wine and I'm thinking, get myself mentally ready for work. And indeed, there was already concerns in the studio that they'd kind of gone too far, even before the broadcast had finished. At 8:32, Davidson Taylor, who worked for CBS as a supervisor, was called into a room and kind of gets effectively a bollocking and comes in and tells them that they need to kind of put a sting in there in the middle of the show saying this wasn't real. But by the time he came back in, the break was already, booked in for a minute's time anyway, so they just did it then. Apparently, after the broadcast, the police started arriving. And there's stories that Houseman... and there's stories of phone call from a mayor from a Midwestern town, not clear which one, who told them that there were mobs on the streets. So producer John Houseman is said to have said after the performance, "The following hours were a nightmare. The building was suddenly full of people in dark blue uniforms. Hustled out the studio, we were locked in a small back office on another floor. Here we sat, incommunicado, while network employees were busily collecting, destroying, or locking up all scripts and records of the broadcast. Finally, press was let loose upon us, ravening for horror. How many deaths had we heard of, implying that we knew thousands? What did we know of the fatal stampede in a Jersey Hall, implying that one of many? What traffic deaths? The ditches must be chocked full of corpses. Suicide. How many heard about the one on Riversdale Drive? It was all quite vague in my memory and quite terrible." apparently Orson Welles, the stories that Welles was kind of locked in a room all night, and that's not true. What actually happened was he returned to the Mercury Theatre where they were doing an all-night rehearsal of a show. And but in Times Square, his name flashed up. Orson Welles causes panic. I know Welles was known for having, you know, quite an overly confident man, but even by his own standards, I'm sure he was taken aback. But there's this idea that listeners had listened to a portion of the program, not all of it. They'd missed the start where it says, this is a radio drama, and kind of listened to a part of another more popular show, then kind of tuned into the other one. Welles' plan was to finish the rehearsals before dawn and then go to bed and sleep in the morning, basically. And as he was leaving in the morning, he gets a call and gets demanded by CBS to go to a press conference, mainly to kind of clear a lot of this stuff up. We kind of apologised and kind of suggested that it was all a terrible idea and he wished he hadn't done it. And that, you know, he kind of regretted the decision that, you know, he was not there for panic. It was just a kind of a good ghost story, a good, you know, good horror tale, I should say.
Do it again. But you don't play down the melodramatic effect of a melodrama.
Have you altered your plans for future problems in any way as a result of this incident?
Naturally, we will have to sit down and think very carefully about future broadcasts.
Have you made any specific changes in any programs that were already scheduled, such as next week, for instance?
No.
Mr. Wells,
three short stories.
On this program would know that there was no such thing as Martians.
Well, it would seem to me unlikely that the people of an invasion from Mars would find ready acceptance. I was frankly terribly shocked to learn that it did.
And that's kind of where a lot of the thought process was. You know, there was a lot, there was like thousands and thousands and thousands of, like 12,000 articles in the press about the excitement. It was a real media storm, an old school media, a storm, an attack on, like, you know, other people and that kind of thing. And like a lot of those kind of stories, if it's in the press a lot, people kind of just kind of assume it's right. And, you know, a lot of modern day history, you know, recent, you know, in our own lifetime, not in our lifetimes, but, you know, 20th century history is based on, you know, eyewitness reports and also press reports. So these 12,000, which kind of all corroborated each other, effectively said, it's true, there was panic on the streets. And then Hadley Cantrell, in 1940, wrote a publication called The Invasion from Mars. Now, it's a Princeton psychology professor who wrote it. So, and it kind of looks at the reasons why people might be panicking, and it puts in a sociological context of the last 5 years beforehand, etc. And a lot of that is based on, you know, people were already in a heightened state because they'd be hearing terrible news, you know. It felt like we could be going to war again. But what it also did was inflate the number of people that listened to the program. There's an assumption that it was a big show, and it wasn't. One of the problems that that program had was it didn't have a sponsor, and that's a good indication that, you know, it was not a popular program at all. In fact, it's only after the massive hoo-ha that Campbell Soup got on board and gave them some money. And of course, that kind of dubious fact check and linked with the fact that a lot of the stories are obviously anecdotal, because, you know, there wasn't a lot of evidence that there was a scare, kind of take away some of the impact of a lot of this. And so, in the 25th, but you know, nonetheless, that was the assumption, the knowledge of the 20th century about what happened in 1938, that it'd gone out, it was a popular show, and shit went down, basically. It was, you know, it was a bit of a mess. It's only in the 21st century when people start looking at it as a, you know, a bit differently and a bit broader, that they start changing their minds. The obvious thing is that the number of people who actually listen to the program is a lot less than thought. Even though 80% of the nation had radios, it's estimated that probably around 2% was actually listening. And obviously, there's eyewitness reports at the time that kind of said, you know, there is no one outside at the moment. People are not in their cars trying to escape this monster. And I think as well, and this is probably the bigger thing, there were 2,000 letters mailed to Wells and the Federal Communications Commission after the broadcast. Now, these are currently held as part of the Wells Archive in Michigan and in National Archives and Records. And 27% of them are from people saying, this show actually frightened me. So what we have is a classic media storm, one that didn't go away. The most interesting thing about that was that as time went on, you know, it went from it's outrageous that they would publish this stuff, shifted to it's absolutely ridiculous that people would be scared by this. And in the comment sections and whatever, you know, all the, in the same way now Twitter is a mine of the obvious hot takes of outrage, then outrage and outrage, and then a kind of knowing dismissal of whatever the issue is. That cycle, that media cycle continues today. Or to continue, you know, but at the time it's exactly the same with, but played out in the newspapers. And indeed, there wasn't, although some people tried to bring, to take the, Wells and CBS to court, nothing came of them. And indeed, there wasn't any real, callback from the regulator either. Mainly because CBS went, well, we just won't do fake broadcasting dramas anymore. How's that? And they went, yeah, that'll do. Which kind of is a very mature way to look at it. But to give you an idea of you know, the kinds of letters that it could get, and bear in mind that this could easily be somebody just reacting to the news. This is a transcript from a letter that was received to the Federal Communications Commission, the regulator, Washington, D.C. Complaint, WABC broadcast, in caps. Gentlemen, to avoid a reoccurrence of a very grave and serious situation that developed in this community last night due to the public's misinterpretation of the broadcast through WABC around 8:15, dramatising H.G. Wells' War of the World, which completely crippled communication facilities of our police department for about 3 hours, I am requesting that you immediately make an investigation and do everything possible to prevent a recurrence. The situation was so acute that 2,000 phone calls were received in about 2 hours, all communication lines were paralysed and voided normal municipal functions. If we had had a large fire at the time, it would have been easily caught a more serious situation. Tremendous excitement existed among certain areas of this community, and we were receiving constantly long-distance phone calls from many states making inquiries of relatives and families thought to have been killed by the catastrophe that was concluded in the play. I can conceive of no reason why the name of Trenton and the vicinity should have been used in this broadcast. The state police were equally handicapped, and it's indescribable the seriousness of the situation. Your prompt attention will be appreciated. Very truly yours, signed, Paul Morton, City Manager. Now, obviously, Mr. Morton was very angry because he was the town that was named. And indeed, in the broadcast, lots of places, like they named real places, in the same way the Wells book did. However, obviously Wells' book isn't in real time. It's like a fact, you know, a historical document. It seemed like it meant to be like an historical document in a museum. And he's pissed off, and he's had a lot of phone calls, however many that lot is, of people phone, you know, listening to something on the radio, being confused, and then calling up. Now, however many people that actually was, if it was 2,000, we don't know. But certainly, mass hysteria would not equate to that number of phone calls. So that's probably the most strongly worded letter that you could get in this situation. I mean, you know, a guy who's genuinely affected by it, or I was pissed off mainly because, you know, he's working a shift. He's got mad guys in there, and they're getting inundated by the calls because someone's named them on a silly program. Can you not do that again? Fair enough. This is another letter which kind of shows the flip side to that, which was also sent to the FCC by J.V. Yuki. Gentlemen, I have read considerable concerning the programme of Orson Welles presented over the Columbia Radio Broadcasting System Sunday evening. I suppose that by this time you have received many letters from numerous cranks and crackpots who quickly become jitterbugs during the programme. As one of the thousands who heard the programme, I did not jump out of the window, did not attempt suicide, did not break my arm while beating a hasty retreat from my department, did not anticipate a horrible death, did not hear the Martians rapping on my chamber door. Good Poe reference. Did not see the monsters landing in warlike regalia in the park across the street, but sat serenely entertained no end by the fine portrayal of a fine play. The Mercury Theatre has been one of the radio highlights of the week for me this fall. This Sunday, the programme Sunday, I felt, was one of their better programmes. Should your commission contemplate serious measures toward the Columbia Broadcasting System, my suggestion would be that the Mercury Theatre be directed to rebroadcast the programme and the reaction of all the listening audience be solicited. In the interest of a continuation of the fine things in radio today, I am. Very respectfully yours, signed. P.S. I am in the State Administrative Office of the South Dakota State Employment Service, and every member of our staff who heard the programme subscribes to what I have to say. Ruined it at the end there, mate. I won't lie to you. Don't speak for groups of people off anecdotal evidence. Very poor form. So what we have, I mean, with the documentary, which kind of the reason why, you know, I'd be like, why would you do that? I suppose what they had letters. Like not like the good one I've just sent, but, and they had like five or six, and they kind of read them out, and they have an actor doing it, it's quite stilted, and they've got that horrible filter, you get in After Effects to try and make it look old timey on top, it's quite cheap. And I suppose, you know, the myth of the War of the Worlds broadcast is far more exciting than the reality of the War of the Worlds broadcast. And it's a good story, although really the making of it is interesting more from Wells being, you know, being all over the place. I mean, he's, what, 23 at that point? And I suppose, you know, I find it fascinating that he's basically working non-stop. Like, you know, do Sunday, get into rehearsal, do all-nighter, get sleep the next day, and you do on to the next show. And, you know, he's juggling so many plates. And he has this reputation for just being a genius. The programme, in the fairness, does kind of say, as a throwaway line, it's probably unlikely that this was a, you know, an actual scare, you know, that it's been blown out of proportion in the press. And, you know, obviously the myth of it is far more exciting and interesting than there was a programme and then there were some news stories afterwards and it was a bit of a major scare and no one cared. Anyway, Wells obviously was very apologetic at the time but completely abused the myth. You would be miffed, wouldn't you? I mean, you'd be really annoyed because, you know, you're getting all this hassle from people. You get lots of people trying to say, you know, you're ruining their lives. And, you know, the obviously the risk of litigation. But at the same time, once that had gone away, and, you know, the storm and the teacup had gone away, he did kind of say that he'd, you know, in an interview said apparently houses were emptying, churches filling up from Nashville to Minneapolis, there was wailing in the streets and the rendering of garments, which is fantastic phrase, and you know, but you know, at the same time, obviously that's fucking bollocks. And, you know, CBS in the past have used it, the myth, to kind of say, you know, how important radio was. And, you know, it was a big deal. And, you know, we were in each other's ear, even though it wasn't the most popular show at the time. And, in fact, a variety performance with starring a couple of, variety comedy, basically, with ventriloquism. Radio ventriloquism? What is that about? You know, let's do some ventriloquism now, shall we? It just doesn't make any sense. Anyway, so New Jersey, the attack is on Grover's Mill, as we've heard in the broadcast before. And in 1988, they had a 50th anniversary, 4 days of, you know, panel discussions. They put a time capsule in their dinner dances. Really nice homespun fun, I think. And And George Takei, you know, they did a rebroadcast of the show. And I, as I understand it, this American Experience program was created to kind of celebrate 75 years. So maybe that was more of a reason why they decided to do it in the way they did it. Because, you know, if you kind of turn around and go, yeah, but it's bollocks, it's not the most exciting hour of TV, is it? I urge you to go back and listen to it again. I'm a bit umiari about the copyright on it, so I'm not going to... You know, the first thought was just slash the end of this, but I think you're probably best not to do that. What I'll do is I'll put a link on the podcast notes, you know what I mean? You know, if you click on the more detail button, there'll be a link on there, and it'll just fire straight to YouTube. And that's somebody else's problem then, isn't it? But I do urge you to listen to it again. It's interesting. I wouldn't say it's the best radio drama, and I wouldn't say it's even particularly frightening, but it does use its tools very well. And there is that interesting comparison between real tragedy and this faux tragedy. You know, I think normally, traditionally, that kind of stuff plays. You do that kind of stuff when you're in a period of calm, of serenity, when you feel safe. Now, Wells may have personally felt, you know, very safe in himself and relaxed, and feel therefore that there would be no need to worry about, you know, scaring people, because these radio broadcasts aren't scary. However, I do think that the news was quite frightening at the time. So that's probably poorly timed might be a better way to look at it. Maybe a little bit too good in terms of its elements of the broadcast, regardless of the fictional network and the obviousness of that fictional. And when you listen to it regular out, you know, on modern ears, I mean, even then, you would have been like, how have we been taken over in 30 minutes? You know, it's very quick. I think we're far more aware that real tragedies take a lot longer. Although I do wonder if somebody did something like that today, using modern means of communication, would people be happy with that? Or would they be equally annoyed if you did something with, I don't know, a mixture of online and TV over a 30-minute period about something ridiculous that couldn't happen, like an alien invasion, but made it believable? You put enough in it. If you had, you know, eyewitness accounts and Twitter feeds and stuff like that, I think people would probably buy it to an extent, and then probably have a conspiracy theory about the fact that it actually happened, but it got covered up. However, I'm not convinced that there was... I don't know, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, generally, the thought is that there wasn't any panic because not enough people listened to it, but how do you define panic? You might be, you know, I mean, obviously people on the streets, people, you know, people didn't commit suicide, they didn't run into their cars and drive, allegedly. Although, you know, and if only a few people do it, does it even matter? You know, is that just the people being idiots? The other thing I'd say as well is that obviously in the UK, you know, we can't exactly throw any stones on this one. We had our own equally strange and surreal and also now disproved and discounted version of the scare with Ghostwatch in 1992. I'm not going to go into much detail about that because if you want to listen to that, you can go back to the Enfield Poltergeist episode of the Last Horror Podcast where I go into that kind of detail and talk about that as part of that story. I think for me, though, I love, and I think one of the reasons why I love War of the Worlds broadcast so much is it feels like a very live experience broadcast across the nation, very, you know, and in a lot of different places. And, you know, a group of people in one little room and being broadcast out live and has an impact, a genuine impact of all these people just sitting quietly on a Sunday night, excited to listen to the latest radio program. And I think for me, that's what makes it so good. And I think that's possibly why people are, you know, why there was this element of, you know, media for all. I mean, a lot of, obviously, you know, you could argue the media got angry because it kind of mocks the media a little bit, or, you know, kind of it suggests that there might be problems there. But what it does as well, you know, it's live, it's happening now, and this is reaction to live. And regardless of the fact that almost all the evidence of actually affecting anybody is anecdotal, there's still a deep primal excitement that sits behind that.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business. So goodbye, everybody, and remember, please, for the next day or so, the terrible lesson you learned tonight. That grinning, glowing, globular invader of your living room is an inhabitant of the pumpkin patch, and if your doorbell rings and nobody's there, that was no Martian, it's Halloween.
Right, thanks very much for that. If you want to get hold of me, please do. My email address is christopher@thelasthorrorpodcast.com. My Twitter is @orange_monkey. And you can go to the website, thelasthorrorpodcast.com, where there's all these articles and stuff like that and various bits and bobs. Next week, I'm going to do a wider history of radio horror tales. Like, old-time radio is like a big thing, and yeah, things like Lights Out and Suspense. I've kind of talked around it in the past, but let's do a big old chunky history of and kind of get some good clips in there. And yeah, it'd be a really nice kind of episode. Anyway, if you want to donate to the show, you can do. Just go click on the Buy Me a Coffee button at the top of the website and you can make a little donation to help maintain the running costs of the program. So until next week, where I bore you further with my love of old radio, take care and I'll speak to you soon. Goodbye.